I'm in a position to know, because the Patrick Henry Society has studied the whole thing. The real problem, whether you like it or not, is whether you're going to sit back and let desegregation spread throughout the entire South. And it's an indisputable fact that there could be no other result. The Negroes will literally, and I do mean literally, control the South. The vote will be theirs. You'll have black mayors and black policemen the way they do in Chicago and New York already. Like as not, a black governor and black doctors to deliver your babies. If they find time, that is. And that's the way it'll be. Did you ever stop to think about that? When you let those 10 enter your school, did you?
Well, most of the country did sit back. And just exactly what Bill Shatner said happened. Yeah, that's right. And he didn't wait till he did Star Trek to say it either. Yeah. Hey, White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance. This is Tom Metzger. Terrible Tommy in the bunker here, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station. And that's right next to our Weapons of Mass Destruction Used and Abused Equipment Yard. That's closed right now. We'll be open in April. And you can come on down here and pick up your weapon of choice to take back to what and to do whatever you want to do with it, because we believe in the right to keep and bear tanks, the right to keep and bear artillery shells, and so forth and so on. Yeah. You can write to us there at P.O. Box 401. That's where you send your donations for the radio show or for POWs or whatever you want to do. And we'll take care of it from there. Now, we're sending quite a few magazines and books out, not a landslide, but to selected people who we think deserve it. And some of them even pay for it. So anyhow, then go up to Box, go up to resist.com and get an education. You need an education. Everybody needs an education. Even I can use more education. Yeah. And it's you can download books or radio shows or just about anything you want up there. Get a better than a Harvard education. Harvard education isn't worth a shit anymore. And now on with the shoe. And this is the 18th of February. That's right. Now today we're celebrating the birthday of Richard Gert Butler, the past creator and head of Aryan Nations up in Idaho, who's been passed away for some time. So this is his birthday. So lift a beer to Pastor Butler. Also, this is the anniversary of the creation of the Aryan Women's League, founded in 1989 on the 18th of February. It's not with us anymore. We combined the Aryan Women's League with the regular War Association. And so the Aryan Women's League as an entity is not around anymore. But this is the day. This is their birthday. You know, every person that has political power in this country has criminality in their background. Every great family in this country has a lot of crimes to answer for. Bill Clinton and Hillary, that's the way you climb to the top. You've got to be a crook. There's no other, in the American way, there's no other way of getting there. So if you're not aiming to be a crook and even resort to eliminating your enemies, forget it. You'll never get to the top. Now let's look in on Billy Boy Clinton and see what I'm talking about. Wait a minute.
Sex slaves, pedophilia, this is the modern world. Attempted to the buzzsaw.
Central Intelligence Agency. It was described by witnesses as...
I'm joined today by a couple of guests. Conchita Sarnoff is the author of an upcoming book about tentatively titled Sex Slaves in America, about the Jeffrey Epstein pedophilia case, which is going to be a fascinating story. She's also the founder and executive director of Alliance to Rescue Victims of Trafficking. Her daughter is joining us as well, Christina Sarnoff, who's also fascinated by this topic of slavery in the modern world, and she's working on her first documentary film that would hopefully expose and highlight how it's playing into our modern economic systems. So thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you, Sean.
This will be a very interesting topics to explore because the pedophilia story is getting out a little bit more, especially in the United Kingdom, where the police are beginning to take more credence of the testimony of witnesses who've alleged against politicians and celebrities. I think this goes back to sort of 2012 when Jimmy Savile and Britain and these other guys were accused of pedophilia. And so the UK is becoming a scandal, but in the United States, it's sort of been hushed up. And you've personally experienced that because this billionaire named Jeffrey Epstein basically walked away with less than 2 years after having sexual experiences with young women. So why don't you describe a little bit of that story and how you got into it?
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Sean, for having us and having me on the show. You're absolutely right. As you know, Fox just released a show. It was on pedophilia and what's happening in the UK, because The Guardian had published an article about Jimmy Savile and all top-level officials and how it's been hushed for so many years. So how does that translate to the United States, and why is it that the topic of pedophilia is such a closed conversation? Mm-hmm. And clearly one of the reasons is because you have pedophilia at such high levels of government, at the highest echelons of government. You have a group of men who clearly partake in this, and they have now called, or they are trying to categorize pedophilia as a sexual orientation, which mm-hmm. I think is quite shocking. That we in the United States, and I would like to know who in fact is behind the research, who in fact is behind the study that would categorize pedophilia as a sexual orientation.
And I think the idea being that it may not be accepted right now, but if they can continue to push this idea across and start to teach it in 20 or 30 years' time,
absolutely,
it might become acceptable for mass culture.
Absolutely.
I think that agenda.
Absolutely, I agree. And, well, as pedophilia was actually not the reason why I began my study and investigation into human trafficking. The reason I began that investigation was because I met a woman, Deborah Sigmund, back in 2006 in Washington, who ran a foundation called Innocence at Risk. And the purpose of that foundation is to raise awareness of human trafficking. Simultaneously, I was working in Mexico, and the foreign minister of Mexico said to me something that stuck and reverberated for months. And he said to me, you know, you Americans are a bunch of hypocrites. You buy our drugs, you sell us your weapons, and now you're stealing our children. And that statement would not leave my mind for so many months. So given that there was this collusion between the Deborah Sigmund's invitation to have me join her board and the statement that the foreign minister made, and the fact that when I started to research human trafficking, it was just beginning to unfold in this country. This is 2006. Mm-hmm. I decided to investigate the issue. And so I went to Mexico. I spent about a year and a half, almost 2 years. And during that investigation, I find that at that time, the biggest human trafficking case was a 2005, forgive me, a 2006 case where a local trafficking family had trafficked dozens of girls. I don't know the number exactly, but they had been trafficked from a small town in Mexico called San Miguel de Tenancingo, which today happens to be one of the principal cities still in Mexico that traffics children into the United States. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows why that particular city has become such an important source city, but it is. And so I started to investigate there, and I found that this one Mexican girl had been trafficked from San Miguel de Tenancingo to New York to Palm Beach. During that investigation, I find the Jeffrey Epstein case. Well, the Jeffrey Epstein case, of course, takes me into a whole different direction, because not only are we now talking about a man who is a very wealthy American man, he is a hedge fund manager, he at the time was a well-known Wall Street financier, worth allegedly $2 billion, and his case, when I start to investigate, had over 24 kids that had reported to the police sexual abuse by him and by a number of procurers, none of whom have been indicted to this day. So when I started that investigation, I realized, you know, this man allegedly trafficked not only children from the United States, he also trafficked foreign-born girls. And some of these children were trafficked to foreign countries, such as this one girl, Virginia Louise Roberts, who has been in the news since December 2014, when Josh Gerstein from Politico.com revealed in a in an article, in a blog, excuse me, that one of the attorneys who represented, who advised, guided Epstein throughout his case was also allegedly implicated. His name is Alan Dershowitz. Mm-hmm. And so Gerstein posted this blog, and since then there has been a media frenzy over who's been involved in the case and why has there been that cover-up. The specifics are clear. Epstein was arrested in 2005. He actually was not arrested. He handed himself in. Over 24 girls testified against Mr. Jeffrey Epstein. And since then, there have been a slew of names, including former President Bill Clinton, who would be an excellent material witness in the case, and Alan Dershowitz. Former Governor Bill Richin was also implicated. David Copperfield was implicated in the case. He's mentioned in one of the transcripts that Virginia Louise Roberts gives two attorneys in Florida, Brad Edwards and Jack Scarola. And so here is a number of politicians, of prime ministers, and a British royal.
Prince Andrew.
Correct. And according to this one victim, Virginia Louise Roberts, she was forced or coerced to have relations, sexual relations with Prince Andrew in the UK. Mm-hmm. Why hasn't this case had more exposure? Two, why wasn't Mr. Epstein prosecuted under the Federal Law Trafficking Victims Protection Act? Big question. Florida enacted TVPA in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. The law was there. That's what the law is there for. Under that law, every trafficker is prosecuted, gets minimum mandatory of 20 years.
Right.
Mr. Epstein was prosecuted under two counts of solicitation of prostitution with a minor, and he got only 18 months.
Right. I think you answered the question when you said, why hasn't it received more exposure? It's quite embarrassing to have former presidents and politicians and a royal family member implicated in this, having sex with minors. And when we talk about minors, I mean, what age are we talking here?
14. Well, in one of the depositions, allegedly there were two 12-year-old girls brought over to Mr. Epstein at his private island in the USVI, United States Virgin Islands. So for one of his birthdays, according to one of the victims, there were two little girls brought over from France, and each child was 12.
Wow. And the point being that the authorities are simply not taking these testimonies seriously to actually further the prosecution?
You know, I can't answer for the authorities. The only thing that I can answer is that based on the court files and the interviews with victims and law enforcement and prosecutors and attorneys that I have personally had, I know that there is not one person, including the former prosecutor who prosecuted Epstein, who believes that he was given the kind of sentence that he deserved.
I see.
And that, to me, is proof that something went wrong. There are many details in the case that I will prove in my book. That's why I've wanted to write this book. Not only because this is such an important story, it is a precedent-setting case in the United States. It climbed its way to the 11th Circuit Court in Atlanta. The victims won that case. It's very complex in terms of the law, but thanks to the perseverance of the attorneys who are representing the victims, for no money, mind you, Brad Edwards and a former federal judge, Paul Cassell, this case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court then ruled in favor of the... They did not hear the case, of course, and so the 11th Circuit Court's decision stood, which means that the two victims, Jane Doe 1 and Jane Doe 2, under the Children's Victims' Rights Act, have now the permission to see all the documents that were sealed that were communicated between Epstein's attorneys, and the Department of Justice back in 2007 when the Department of Justice issued Epstein a non-prosecution agreement. Mm-hmm. That is unusual, to say the least. This is a trafficking case. Clearly, it's a trafficking case. And in a trafficking case, I don't know how many sex traffickers, registered sex offenders, such as Epstein. He's a level 3 registered sex offender, which is the highest category of a sexual offense that one can commit. He is not monitored. He was not monitored, according to several attorneys. He also violated 11 parole. He committed 11 parole violations. Mm-hmm. No repercussions there as well. He never took the state psychological exam, something that is usually mandatory of pedophiles and criminals who commit sex crimes against children. So there were many peculiarities about this case that struck me as curious and made me realize that, you know, this book, this case, should not really be about Epstein. It should be about the girls. It should be about the victims. It should be about the children. Who's protecting the children?
Well, I'm not going to run that entire interview. It's over half an hour long, but you got the message. You got the information. Billionaires and big-shot politicians and even royal family people get away with murder. They always have. They always have. And then they parade themselves as being the virtuous people that are responsible for applying the law to you and me. So think of all the guys sitting in prison over some pot or something like that, maybe some cocaine or whatever, or defending themselves as white people, while people like Bill Clinton, son of a bitch, and his paramour wife, are both criminals. Alan Dershowitz, how about that? Another Jew. And he's the biggest hypocrite of them all, probably. He's always, oh, how horrible racism is, how horrible this is, and how horrible that is. But yet there he is, evidently involved in child pedophilia. Let's talk about your retirement funds, if you have some. And where are they going to go? Well, during the State of the Union address, Obama discussed the MIRA program. The aim is simple: dupe Americans and dip their dirty fingers into your retirement savings and move them into U.S. government's shrinking coffers. According to Employee Benefit Research Institute, there's well over $23 trillion in individual retirement accounts in the U.S. For a government as bankrupt as we are, $23 trillion is irresistible. They need that money. They need your money. And this MIRA program is critically the first step in corralling your hard-earned retirement funds. As Obama stated, they will allow everyone to voluntarily invest their MIRA accounts and other state-sponsored programs. But when not enough Americans are making it their patriotic duty to invest their money into these state-sponsored programs. They'll mandate compliance with the stroke of a pen, just like they did with Obamacare, which incidentally has become skyrocketing prices with Obamacare. I mean, it's out of this world. The insurance companies love Obama. You wonder why he gets great praise from the insurance companies. They're making more than they ever did. And just like Obamacare, it will be enforced, and failure to comply will mean confiscation without recourse and prison time. All they need now is a trigger, and that trigger will likely come in the form of another stock market collapse. Wipe out Americans in the stock market crash and scare the heck out of them with more economic bad news. And millions of our countrymen will be all too willing to hand it over to Uncle Sam. Panic is a powerful motivator. And what better way to get the people on board than to threatening them with squalor and destitution in their old age if they don't go along? Well, keep an eye on that one. Keep an eye on that one. Well, I see Christ Insanity broadcaster James Dodson is encouraging South Carolina voters to back Senator Ted Cruz as the only viable alternative to Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump. Quote, other Republicans are certainly worthy of consideration, but at this point it looks like a vote for anyone other than Ted Cruz is a vote for Donald Trump. Dodson, founder of Focus on the Family, told supporters in a recorded message paid for by Courageous Conservatives PAC. How about that? Well, the other rumor around is that Jeb Bush, he's got $15 million in his account, but he can't win. So what's he going to do? He's going to spend the rest of his time. He's not going to drop out. He's going to stay in, evidently, and see if he can destroy the ones he don't like. So they're going to call him the Walking Dead zombie. I've noticed several times that Bernie Sanders, instead of just raising his hand and to say hello, goodbye, and hooray, is raising the clenched fist. Now, if you were around when I was around back in the 70s and even the 60s, all of the extreme left-winger Marxist types were given the clenched fist salute. And I see a picture here this morning. He's at a rally. Big smile on his face, giving a clenched fist salute. I think that means something. I think it definitely means something. Denver, chances are you've heard of John Lewis, the short little nigger that the Georgia congressman and civil rights icon who was beaten by Alabama state troopers in 1965 during a march for voting rights. It's less likely that you've heard of Patrick Demmer, pastor of the African American Church in Denver. Yet when it comes to the Democratic presidential race, Mr. Demmer may signify a ferment in African American attitudes towards the candidates. Mr. Lewis is backing Hillary Clinton for Democratic presidential nomination, part of a phalanx of prominent national Negro leaders who've lined up behind the party's front runner. Mr. Demmer introduced her rival, Senator Bernie Sanders, at a rally in Denver last week that drew a crowd of 18,000. Quote, I was told that African Americans have to be with the other candidate, he said. Not him, he said. After studying up on Mr. Sanders, he said he's all in for Sanders. Whose endorsement matters more, the congressman's or the reverend's? Who's thinking about the candidates is more in sync at the moment with the hearts and minds of Negro American voters? It matters. After two contests in largely white states, the Democratic contest now moves to states with larger concentrations of Negroes, otherwise known as niggers. Nevada on Saturday, South Carolina on February 27th, and Georgia and Alabama and Arkansas, among others. And boy, oh boy, they got blacks. Black voters could prove decisive, and the competition to woo them is fierce. When the blacks are going to learn, they're not going to get much out of it. Mrs. Clinton is casting Mr. Sanders as a single-issue candidate, more focus on income inequality than issues of race and discrimination. Mr. Sanders is trying to introduce himself to Negro voters in a hurry, reminding them of his 1988 endorsement of Jesse Jackson over any number of white men in the field. As ever, Mrs. Clinton came to this fight with clear advantages. Her husband, former two-term crook President Bill Clinton, remains a popular figure in the Negro community. I bet he is. Former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell recalled a recent interview a day in 2010 when Mr. Clinton visited a black church in West Philadelphia. In his speech, Mr. Clinton called President Barack Obama the first black president. The congregants interrupted. "Second," they shouted, "second," meaning they viewed Mr. Clinton as the first black president. As a former senator, first lady, and secretary of state, Ms. Clinton has had a quarter century to build ties with Negro leaders, and she has succeeded. The Congressional Black Negro Caucus endorsed her last week, and its members plan to fan out across South Carolina, vouching for her in black precincts. Mr. Sanders comes from Vermont, a state whose black population is 1%, and he likes it that way. Running for elective office on and off for the past 40 years, he had no compelling electoral reason to plunge into issues important to the black community, or for that matter, court Negro American votes at all. And yet he's making headway, perhaps not with the black leadership, but with people closer to the ground. Ta-Nehisi Coates, an acclaimed African American writer, has said he will vote for Mr. Sanders. Leaving the Denver rally, Joseph and Nachacha Ridley, a mixed-race couple, said that Mr. Sanders has gained traction with friends in their social circles. "People make up their minds, Mr. Ridley said. "I personally think, and what I see and hear from our black friends, is they're supporting Bernie and not supporters of Hillary. Then there are people like Mr. Demmer, the Denver pastor, who sees a divide between the older black political establishment and the African Americans willing to take a fresh look at Mr. Sanders and rethink conventional notions that the Clintons were loyal allies of Negro voters." He mentions parts of Mr. Clinton's record that he says did black households no favors, including an overhaul of the welfare system and tough-on-crime laws that expanded the prison population. The older establishment drank the Kool-Aid. They bought into this ideology that Bill Clinton was the first black president, unquote, he said in an interview. Quote, "They were so happy to feel like they had a friend in the White House. They bought into that hook, line, and sinker. As for me, I'm going to bite into another hook, line, and sinker." But opinions of Mrs. Clinton haven't necessarily hardened. Polls show she enjoys a comfortable lead among Negroes. A CNN or ORC poll released Tuesday showed in South Carolina Mrs. Clinton led Mr. Sanders among black voters 65-28%. Yet in an encouraging sign for Mr. Sanders, about two-thirds of the black voters said they were still making up their minds. I ain't made up my mind, man. On Sunday, Ms. Lewis showed up at an African-American Negro-American church in Las Vegas with Mrs. Clinton, where he described her as ready to be president day one. Mr. Sanders needs many more people to see the world like Mr. Demmer. Mrs. Clinton must hope that African-American Negroes will heed Mr. Lewis. Oh, man, it's going to keep me awake worrying about that one. Well, that was a little hard to understand. There's a bunch of Negroes out in the rain with umbrellas and yelling about there's going to be a race war. There's going to be a race war in this country. That's what he said. Going to be a race war. Coming race war. Metzger's right. Yeah. Let's peek in on an article here about going back to O.J. a little bit. Remember O.J.? He got off scot-free, didn't he? At least for the murder of two people. How about that?
20 years after the so-called trial of the century, FX is presenting the miniseries The People v. O.J. Simpson. Like 100 million other people across the country, I watched the 1995 murder trial on television. I also was a legal commentator for CBS News and Court TV. Cameras in the courtroom, television and the pursuit of justice, a book I co-authored with veteran CBS News correspondent David Dow, was based largely on the Simpson case. I used transcripts and examples from the trial in my evidence and criminal procedure classes at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. I am still convinced that race played a major role in the not guilty verdict. It is no surprise that the miniseries begins with the vicious 1991 beating of Rodney King and the riots that ensued after the 1992 acquittal of the four Los Angeles Police Department officers who assaulted King. The incident, which had been recorded on videotape, went viral. The jurors in the Simpson trial were well aware of the King case. Nine of the jurors were African American, and one was Latino. The case was tried in downtown Los Angeles. These jurors knew the LAPD was notorious for committing misconduct, especially against blacks, and they could well believe that the police had framed Simpson. The prosecution made several strategic errors that enabled the jury to find reasonable doubt. Since the jurors were sequestered for 9 months, they became a tight unit. It didn't take them long to agree on the not guilty verdict. During the preliminary hearing, LAPD Detective Mark Foreman denied that he had used the N-word in the previous 10 years. At trial, the defense presented two witnesses who testified that Foreman had recently used the expletive. Since the preliminary hearing was televised, these defense witnesses came forward after seeing Foreman's testimony on TV. The issue shifted from Simpson's guilt to Foreman's racism. As prosecutor Marcia Clark intoned during the trial, there was a mountain of evidence against Simpson. His blood was discovered at the crime scene in Brentwood, an affluent neighborhood of Los Angeles, and blood matching the victims, Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, was found on a glove. Three different laboratories analyzed the DNA, but Simpson's dream team of top lawyers challenged the collection of the blood evidence and raised the issue of possible contamination. The jury apparently believed that Foreman, a racist, could have planted the bloody glove on Simpson's property. Blacks and whites, by and large, reacted differently to the not guilty verdict, according to a Los Angeles Times poll. While most white people thought Simpson was guilty, many African Americans felt vindicated by the verdict. For blacks, Columbia professor John McWhorter wrote in the New York Times, it was about the centrality of police brutality to black Americans' very sense of self. Viewing the verdict 20 years later through the prism of the Black Lives Matter movement, it is not difficult to understand. We see unjustified killings of black men all too often. Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, Freddie Gray, Michael Brown and many others come to mind. Talk to most black people about racism, McWhorter noted, and you need only count the seconds before the cops come up. The country's polarization between Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter and the pundits' divergent opinions on Beyoncé's Super Bowl halftime performance parallel the racial divide we saw in the aftermath of the Simpson trial. Many white people have tried to dilute the critical slogan Black Lives Matter by saying, well, all lives matter. Of course they do, but the history of this country is permeated with institutional racism and prejudice. Beyoncé's dancers were dressed as Black Panthers, and in her video for her newest single, Formation, released the day before the Super Bowl, she dramatized the racist response to the Katrina tragedy by lying on a New Orleans police car as it sank into floodwaters. We have come a long way since the days of slavery and Jim Crow, and we do have a black president. But institutional racism is unfortunately alive and well in the United States. Mass incarceration, racial profiling, infant mortality and lack of access to quality education and health care all disproportionately affect African Americans. As we ponder whom to support in the presidential primaries, let us ask ourselves which candidate will passionately and tirelessly fight racism on the institutional level. That means creating jobs, implementing universal health care, ending the militarism of the police and advocating legislation to reduce the draconian sentences that disproportionately impact African Americans. It is commonly thought that Hillary Clinton is more committed to the black community than Bernie Sanders is. But in the 1980s, when Clinton was the First Lady of Arkansas, she vilified public school teachers and their union. Many or most of them were African American, and as legal scholar and the new Jim Crow author Michelle Alexander has pointed out, the U.S. prison population increased more under Bill Clinton than any other president. He supported racial disparity in sentencing and the heavy-handed three strikes. When Hillary Clinton advocated for the 1994 Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act, which created 60 new death penalty offenses, provided $9.7 billion for prisons and eliminated inmate education programs, she used racially coded rhetoric to cast black children as animals, Alexander wrote in The Nation. Clinton said at the time, they are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended that way, but first we have bring them to heel. Bring them to heel. When civil rights icon John Lewis announced that the Political Action Committee of the Congressional Black Caucus was endorsing Hillary Clinton in the 2016 presidential election, he said he had never encountered Bernie Sanders during the civil rights movement. But as Tim Murphy points out in Mother Jones, Sanders was very active in the movement at the University of Chicago. As president of the University of Chicago's Congress of Racial Equality, Sanders organized pickets and sit-ins. He was arrested for resisting arrest when he protested segregation. As Democrats make their choice for presidential nominee, all of us must ask which candidate would better serve the interests of all of us and work to end racism in every possible way.
Well, that was a bullshit article. I didn't read it before I played it, but I saw a couple of things in there. But there was some interesting points there. Perhaps we should recruit Hillary and Bill, because it seems like they were more racist than the Republicans when they were in power. They just went about it more smartly. Why? That's pretty cool. And they get raised up as heroes. heroes of the black race while they're screwing them.
The George Bush Dick Cheney created Holocaust. The U.S. is supporting mass extermination in Syria. In a small border town on the way to Europe, Syrian refugees tell stories that the world is determined not to hear. Is the U.S. supporting mass extermination in Syria? In a small border town on the way to Europe, Syrian refugees tell stories that the world is determined not to hear. It's midnight and the temperature is close to zero in Prisevo, a small town on the border between Serbia and Macedonia. 8,000 people are standing in the snow, waiting patiently and silently to go through a security check. Many of them are holding small children in their arms, trying desperately to keep them warm. Others are supporting older relatives who can hardly stay awake, as the line slowly moves forward. Some are pushing a family member in a wheelchair. The most unfortunate of them have to do all three things at once. There are no photographers or television crews around. The people in this line are not newsworthy, so long as they don't make any trouble. 8,000 just like them arrived here yesterday. 8,000 more will arrive tomorrow. Yet these people are the beating heart of what policymakers these days bluntly refer to as the European refugee crisis. They are running oftentimes literally out of Syria and Iraq, two countries that no longer exist, except in outdated maps and lousy diplomatic negotiations. Last month, I had the opportunity to speak with more than 70 of them at a transit camp, located halfway into their journey from the collapsing Middle East to Western Europe. It takes almost a month to complete their exodus walking into Turkey from Syria, taking vans and broken buses across the Anatolian plateau, sailing on small boats into Greece, and finally riding overcrowded night trains through Central Europe until reaching Almania, the Arabic name for Germany. On the surface, it's very easy to explain what these people are running away from. They are escaping a brutal regime that just last week was accused by an official UN investigation of conducting mass extermination inside its overstocked prisons. Most people you know would probably make a run for it if they found themselves living under such a regime. But in my conversations with these refugees, I discovered something much more disturbing. It's not just the mass extermination they are running away from, it's also how the world has lately come to accept it, depriving them of any hope that there will ever be an end to the slaughter. The transit camp where I met these refugees is located approximately 1,150 miles from the Syrian-Turkish border but still almost 1,000 miles away from Berlin. Most people arrive there after more than 20 days on the road with at least 5 more days of travel ahead of them. Many told me some variation of the sentence, "I haven't slept for more than a week." And yet, even though the Serbian authorities offer them the chance to stay for a few nights in the large, white UN tents at the center of the camp, very few choose to do so. Most of them stop for registration, take some tea and biscuits offered by a local aid organization, and move on. Rumors about a possible decision by the German government to close its borders because of immigrants' involvement in crime and terrorism are a constant source of paranoia. Such a decision, if taken, would put these people in limbo, can't go back, yet not allowed to move forward. So it's best to keep moving. "Many people don't want us in Germany," said Magdi, a 22-year-old student from Damascus, who is on the road together with his parents and two siblings. "I know there are big protests in the streets there against Merkel, because she's letting us come. That's why no one stops along the way, even if they are sick. Even if they have a sick baby. The most important thing is to make it to a safe place as soon as possible. All the other problems will wait." This wasn't my first encounter with victims of the civil war in Syria. I met Syrian refugees in Jordan in 2011, when the war had just started. In 2012, I smuggled my way into northwestern Syria, to a rebel-controlled area that was completely bombarded by Bashar al-Assad's military. A year later I returned to Jordan's border with Syria, which by then was hosting hundreds of thousands of refugees in camps the size of a city. In 2014, I traveled across the border triangle of Turkey-Syria-Iraq, just as ISIS was making its debut on the world stage. The one rule that applied to all these past visits was still relevant during my reporting trip in Serbia last month: what you hear on any given day is always worse than what you heard last time. During my first Syria reporting trip, back in 2011, I heard gut-wrenching stories of mass shootings and cruel torture techniques used against children. In late 2012, people were already telling me about entire neighborhoods being razed to the ground, and there were also the first rumors that Assad had used chemical weapons against his own people. When ISIS took over large parts of the country a year and a half later, I heard about institutionalized human slavery and about 10-year-olds being taught how to behead living people. All of that was before Russia joined Assad in bombing Syrian civilians in the fall of 2015. By the time I reached the camp in Serbia last month, you could see and taste depression, like nothing I've seen or felt before. The people getting out of Syria right now are those who had the nerves to stay there for the last 5 years, one Syrian man from Aleppo, aged 66, told me as he was waiting for his wife to receive medical treatment in the transit camp. What makes a person run away now, after surviving everything these people have already gone through? What makes tens of thousands do so? We stayed there for 5 years because we thought things will eventually change, he says. People kept saying at some point, it will get better. It has to. The world will intervene. But today, nobody believes it anymore. So everyone is running away now. Everyone. This is only the beginning. The world's failure to stop the massacre in Syria is based on a string of lies. In my conversations with the refugees last month, I asked them about some of these lies as if they were well-established truths. Not because I believe them, but rather, because so many people, all over the world, hear and read these lies every day that it's impossible to ignore them. It felt dumb, for instance, to ask a family father, mother, three children aged 12 to 3 who had just escaped from the burning city of Aleppo, what they thought about Russia's bombing campaign against ISIS. Of course, there is no such thing. Russia isn't focusing its effort on bombing ISIS, but rather on trying to kill the people I was talking to, who are Syrian civilians. Yet conducting the interview without treating this big lie as if it is simply an alternate explanation of events would be considered biased reporting. So, I ask the question and get looks of disbelief, and worse. Nadia, the mother of this family, told me that the Russians are the worst thing that happened to us. We survived everything before them, but when they came in to help Bashar, we said enough. They bomb schools, hospitals, refugee camps, buses carrying people to the border. What specifically did their involvement mean? I asked her. Her reply, I would ask myself every morning, how are the Russians going to try to kill my children today? Her husband, Yasser, a merchant who owned two stores in the city, disagrees with this analysis. He thinks Shiite militia supported by Iran are an even greater danger than Putin's air force. We ran away from the city because we know that after the Russians will finish it, the Iranians will come in. The Iranians are sending people to kill us for Assad. These militias, which are entering Syria from neighboring Iraq, have quite a reputation when it comes to killing. They are just like ISIS, only difference is they are Shia and they talk Farsi, says Yasser. Tell me, why isn't anyone bombing them? Why is the entire world only talking about ISIS? The Iranians in Syria burn people alive, burn children and women. Where is the world? The couple then apologized, explaining they had much more to say, but their youngest daughter started crying, and anyway, they had to leave for the bus. They have 6 more days on the road ahead of them before reaching Germany. The biggest lie of them all is that Bashar al-Assad, even more than Vladimir Putin, wants to defeat ISIS. The civil war in Syria, we are told more and more as of late, is actually a choice between Assad and ISIS. Framing the conflict in such terms makes it legitimate and acceptable to cooperate with Assad, a man who is responsible for the deaths of over a quarter of a million people. I tried to ask each and every Syrian I talked to one simple and neutral question that has to do with this falsehood. The question was, who are you running away from? The vast majority of people didn't choose Assad or ISIS, they said they are running away from both. The world needs to understand that Assad and ISIS are not enemies, they are partners in destroying our lives, explained Muhammad, 24, from Aleppo, who stayed in the bombarded city for the last 5 years because he wanted to complete his university studies before getting out. It's like a coin that has two bad sides to it. Doesn't matter which way you flip it, you'll end up dead. As long as there is Assad, there will be ISIS. His violence against the Sunni people in Syria is what created ISIS in the first place. One man in his 50s, who presented himself Aleppo, added, I'm IS, but there are many different kinds of Daesh operating in Syria today. There is Daesh, the people who cut off heads and burn prisoners in cages. There is also Daesh Assad, which is actually much worse, and Daesh Iran, the Iranian militias who rape and murder women in front of their children's eyes. They have much more money and capabilities, and they don't film themselves while doing their atrocities. They are smart enough to hide it from the world. In addition to all these, there is also Daesh Putin. I'm coming from Aleppo, I've seen the results of his bombings. It's a massacre. People are killed like cockroaches under a shoe. And then there is Daesh the West, which I think is the worst. I mean the civilized world, doing nothing to stop all of this. The Assad versus ISIS lie is supported by another falsehood, which is just as important, the Syria peace talks in Geneva. This lie was recently exposed for what it really is, but it will probably return in a new disguise sooner than you think. The participants in these peace talks, which so far have only intensified the scale of the killing, include Russia, the United States, Iran, the Syrian regime, and some representatives of the scattered Syrian opposition. When I ask, doing my very best to keep a straight face, those who are running away from the consequences of these peace talks, if they expect a diplomatic solution to come out of Geneva, the reactions I got were a combination of apathy and eye rolling. Many people weren't even sure what my question was about. I'm sorry, we don't follow these things, responded a 64-year-old woman from Deir ez-Zor, a city in eastern Syria where ISIS and the Syrian military have been clashing for over a year now. She and her husband fled the city, she says, by bribing Syrian military officers who were retreating from the area on helicopters, and took all the money we had in exchange for an hour-long flight away from ISIS. They have two sons who already live in Europe. One of them, she says, is teaching Arabic literature at a British university. My son writes about the Arab world. But the Arab world is dead. Tell me, where is the Arab world? She asks, and answers, Syria is dead. Iraq is dead. Lebanon is going to die. Everything is destroyed. The Syria peace talks are presented to us as an attempt to reach a peace deal between the Syrian regime and the moderate opposition, who will then join forces to defeat ISIS. The United States, we have been told repeatedly, will insist that Assad himself resign and leave Syria before any such arrangement can take place. But that policy seems to be no longer relevant. Because while John Kerry and his aides are talking to Putin's foreign minister, Sergey Lavrov, at ballrooms in Europe, it is Assad supported by Russia and Iran who is gaining victory after victory on the ground in Syria. Many of the refugees I talk to believe this, in fact, is what America wanted the whole time. America wants Assad to win, said Hassan, a 30-year-old teacher from Aleppo, who talked to me while waiting in line to receive painkillers at a clinic in the camp. Why do you think that? I asked him. After all, they have been saying Assad has to go for a long time, before recently starting to broadly hint otherwise. I don't care what they say, he replied. I lost my brother. He was killed by the regime 3 years ago, when he went to buy bread in the street. Many of my friends have also been killed. What did Obama do? Even when Assad used gas against us, they did nothing. Now we know why. The conversation brought up painful memories from my first two reporting trips covering Syria, in 2011 and 2012. Those trips took place before the 2013 Red Line debacle, in which America retreated from its promise to punish Assad if he ever used chemical weapons against his own people. Of course, he eventually did, but punishment never came. The world was a different place before that episode, because people still believed America would, at some point, stop the horrendous massacre taking place in Syria. That's why people from Syria were eager to talk with the international media, to make their voices heard. Please write this down, complete strangers would tell me upon seeing a notebook and a pen in my hands. On a number of occasions, when I was walking around with a camera, I suddenly felt a touch on my shoulder, turned around, and saw a person who had something urgent to say, "Tell your people we are not terrorists, see what Assad did to my baby girl, Obama. Help us." My 2012 visit to Syria took place shortly after Obama had won re-election. One fighter for the real, moderate Syrian opposition asked me, after we filmed a short interview, "Now that Obama doesn't need to win another election, he is going to stop this, right?" I said I have no idea what will happen, but the man was convinced he had the answer to his own question. Yes, he will have to do something now. There are no more excuses, he said, adding, "I want his aides to watch your movie. If they watch your interview with me, they will understand." Hoping that the world will do something was the main reason people from Syria were so glad to talk with journalists like myself during the first 2 years of the war. Very few Syrians I met in 2012 refused to talk with me back then. But last month, in the freezing cold camp in Serbia, dozens of people I approached said no, men and women, young and old, Arabs and Kurds, well dressed and wearing rags. I didn't try to change their minds. What could I possibly tell them? That talking to me would make a difference. That public opinion could create a sense of urgency. That the world needs to know what they're going through. The world knows.